What does it take to make workshops work? And how can we facilitate collaboration that sticks and leads to results? My name is Miriam Hatness, and with the Workshops Work podcast, I'm on the mission to find the magic ingredients that make workshops work. Today with me on the show is John Barnet, and we speak about the very close connection between facilitation and leadership. So stay tuned. And by the way, if you don't have pen and paper at hand to take your own notes, why don't you visit workshops.work and download my free one-page summary. And now, enjoy the show. Hello, John, and welcome to the show.
Hi.
I am looking forward to speaking about leadership and facilitation as you will celebrate your book release, and I'm very curious to hear more about that. And before we dive into the topic, I always like to start with the question, when did you start calling yourself a facilitator?
Well, certainly sometime after I'd been facilitating, I think maybe 10 or 15 years, when I first came across the International Association of Facilitators, I was curious as to what they did. And I discovered some of them were doing the sort of stuff I was doing too. So then I began to use the word facilitator to describe my work here and there, amongst other things. Because I thought I was a psychological group leader or something of that sort, sometimes almost a management consultant. But then I didn't know anything about management, so I couldn't call myself that. So facilitator was a handy title. I didn't know what it meant, and I'm not sure I still do.
So if you had to compare the work or the role of a facilitator as compared to a consultant, where would you see the difference?
I mean, I have a sort of slightly cynical view of consultants. They're people who know the answers and charge you a lot of money to tell you the answer. Or in fact, they might even get you to provide the answer yourself, but still charge you a lot of money. So that's consultants. Facilitators are, well, it's a very wide range of capabilities, but generally a facilitator, if you just take the word to make things easy, facile, they're like people who oil the wheels. They make it easy for processes to happen. There's more to it than that, but that's a pretty good starting point.
I have a similar understanding of the role of a facilitator, to guide a group from confusion to clarity to action.
Yes, but I think there's more to it than that, you see, because you may have a management group. They know what they want to achieve. You run a process for them. You guide them and you get them there. But are they going to the right place? Quite often, this is one of the questions I raise with facilitators. You can be helping people to do what they want to do, but should they be doing that in the first place? Is that really what they ought to be doing? Now, you don't know the answer to that, but you can ask them you can get them to clarify where they're aiming and is that ethical? Is it right for them? My first career was in architecture, and people will present a problem. They say, this is what I want to build, this, this, and this. But when you ask the questions, you find actually that's not really what they ought to be doing at all. So you help them to clarify, I don't need all of that. What I need is this, and it costs me half as much, or maybe twice as much. But, it's a change. It's a clarification of purpose. People may know what their objective is, but they may not have clarified their purpose. And when they do that, they may find their objective changes.
Yeah. So what have you learned from architecture or from your role as an architect about facilitation?
Well, it's a very interesting thing because I had a 20-year career in architecture, so it wasn't wasn't just a fleeting experience of architecture. And so I learned a kind of thinking, the thinking of architects. And that is what enabled me to become a facilitator fairly easily, because it's the same kind of thinking. You're helping your client to design something that doesn't exist, to make real something that doesn't exist. So, it's a long time now since I was an architect, but so people used to ask me, you know, why did you give up architecture? And I would say, well, I haven't given it up. I just don't do the building stuff anymore. The rest of the process is the same.
Wonderful. So what is this thinking that you refer to that architects and facilitators have in common?
It's interesting. It is to do with seeing the context in which something is going to be enacted. Mm-hmm. So you're not just doing the enacting, the designing stuff, but you're seeing the wider context in which that is relevant, in which it makes sense. And so quite often your client is too close to the action, you know, then a nose is against the grindstone, you might say. But actually, you as an outsider are privileged to see it without getting caught in the detail. You've got a broader perspective, and therefore you can help your client also to reframe, to see a wider picture, a different picture of what it is they're trying to do, and that can be very empowering for people.
So to what extent is subject matter expertise then relevant? Because I often think that as a facilitator, sometimes it's actually good not to be too deep into the subject matter in order to keep this outside perspective. But as an architect, you really want to guide also your clients, and you need to know about statics, for instance, or what works and what doesn't, and about the material and whether it fits into the environment, for instance.
Right, but what you're not an expert in dealing with an architectural client, you don't know the details of their lifestyle or their work processes, or, you know, depending on what the context is. Similarly, as a facilitator, I'm sure you find the same. You don't need to know all the detail of your client's work situation. They bring that expertise. You bring a different kind of expertise, which is an expertise to do with relationships and design and visualization and so on. You bring the expertise that enables, it's almost like if you imagine plastic structures that people have, which is their expertise, you make that mobile, fluid, so things can flow together in a novel way, so that the client group can arrive at solutions that otherwise were impossible for them. So this facilitation is to do with the flow. Yeah. You bring flow and fluidity into a situation.
Yeah, makes sense. And to refer what you said earlier is to also point out when the clients or the group are maybe running in the wrong direction or are losing sight of the purpose.
Well, I don't know about your experience, but it's very much my experience that people lose sight of their purpose a little bit. They're busy doing the day job, and to connect with their purpose, they'd have to pause a little, stand back and think, and compare notes. Purposes are not fixed. They evolve with changing circumstances and so on. But generally, a purpose is a very broad framework for thinking about what you're doing with your life or your work. So helping people to reconnect with their purpose is very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
You can have, for instance, a senior management team in a major organization. Everybody knows what the purpose is. This is what we do. We make widgets or whatever. And yet when you say, just hang on a minute, we want to clarify this, and you get people into a process where they're clarifying their purpose, there are usually some surprises in there for people, or for some of the people, if not all of the people. So, you know, we might be a team of a dozen people, and there might be a dozen different kinds, different purposes in there. And until you begin to work on it, you don't discover that actually we've all accumulated a different understanding of our purpose. And when we clarify it, then we become aligned. Suddenly, instead of being separate and pulling in slightly different directions, suddenly we become aligned because we now have taken the trouble to bring our understanding of purpose into common space. Now we share this purpose. Suddenly we are together.
Mm.
Previously we were apart without realizing it.
Which then makes everything else that follows every decision much easier.
Oh.
Because everyone is seeing the same thing. And still I have the impression that to get a group, especially a leadership team, to actually realize that they have different purposes in the room or different understandings of purposes, and to force them almost to pause and to reflect on that. I think that's a challenge because very often these teams, they are interested in quick results, decisions, strategy plans. So in your experience, how do you get them there to realize that this is what they need and then also to align them on this purpose?
How do you get them there? Well, it depends, I think, a little bit. Obviously, you know from your own experience that you need to listen, you need to ask questions, you need to inquire, and you need to generate inquiry. So it's not just you inquiring, it's you and the client group are inquiring together. And it's really important that you do highlight the differences, that people discover the differences, and then they can have a conversation around that. So you want multiple conversations going on until people do actually get an agreed view of their common purpose. Now, I use visual thinking methods to help with that, because it's a tool or a technique that I help to develop and hone and refine, and I know it works. It's very good. It's like the tool that I use is called Logo Visual Thinking, and you could do this with post-it notes, but we prefer little magnetic things because it's like giving people executive toys to play with. People like to play. And it's quite interesting, you know, even a tough senior management team are really a bunch of kids that have grown up and put on suits and so on. But you can appeal to that playfulness and get people to play together. So having toys for them to play with is kind of helpful. I think this is the secret of Lego serious play, really. These techniques appeal to the playful nature that everybody has, even if they buried it deep in their psyche. We all like to play, really, because that's creative. That's when we're creative. We're not creative unless we are playing. So the creativity that you can appeal to and bring into the room, you can get it going within your space that you're working in where people feel safe. That's a very important thing. It's then you as the facilitator create the conditions in which people can feel happy to play, which means that they're happy to co-create. And then you guide that process a little bit. So really, within a fairly short space of time, you can get people through a process that clarifies their common purpose. Their sense of purpose becomes clearer to them. But then they're aligned and they're unified. Then you can build on that. You go on to whatever comes next.
And do you think that then this playful context helps also to go through difficult conversations? Because I think, I mean, in the best of all cases, they play, they have the visualization, and then very quickly they agree on a common purpose. But I can imagine other situations, there might be some tension or even conflict around finding this shared purpose.
Yeah, it's difficult because I've fallen foul of this, actually, of not realizing that it was in the room there was actually people were playing at playing, really, instead of playing at getting towards their purpose, because they had a group that was there was a very deep conflict in the group, irreconcilable ultimately. So although I was gaily helping them to play, it didn't work because I hadn't seen this deep conflict, and they hadn't made it clear. I knew there were issues, but I didn't realize that they were irreconcilable. And if there are irreconcilable issues, then there's no point in looking for common purpose. You need to look for the least distressing way of parting company.
Yeah,
that's a different time. In fact, I did do that quite well on one occasion, where we had a client who was being manipulated by a much more powerful partner in a collaborative venture. And the great thing about the process as I ran it was that they realized that they were being screwed by this more powerful partner. This was a great success, because once they realized that, they no longer needed to look for a common purpose. There wasn't a common purpose. You know, so they could settle down and just say, okay, now we just need to sort out a contract between us. Yeah. Your purpose and my purpose are not the same. Let's move forward to see how we can work together in spite of that.
And what I hear is this responsibility of the facilitator to realize when is a situation reconcilable or not. So what have you learned from this first experience where you realized that too late? What would you do different in the future? And what's the role, actually, or the responsibility in this entire process of the facilitator to point it out?
There's always a degree, I think, to which you are being a kind of corporate therapist. You know, it's a kind of therapy for a dysfunctional group, or a group that is less fully functional, you know, a bit suboptimal. So there's a degree of therapy, and I think it is important to recognize if you come up against blockages that cannot be handled in the way that you were set up to do things. So if somebody's paying you a fee to run a process that you put forward a proposal of some sort and they've agreed to that, and there you are doing it, and suddenly you find, actually, I've been set up here. This isn't what I was contracted to do. So then there's the question, can I now recontract this? You know, can we create a pause? There's no point in just going through the motions.
How do you find this moment? What are the signals that you missed the first time and that you might not miss the next time?
Well, I suppose you have a degree of sensitivity. You always have a degree of sensitivity, but your sensitivity is usually limited to the people in the room, and is the process going as I expected it? Do I need to adjust? Do I need to correct things? Do I need to give somebody more time? Is somebody struggling here that needs more attention from me? So all of those things that you would say are the normal responsibilities of a facilitator. But then I mean, maybe it doesn't happen to other people, but it has happened to me on two or three occasions. I've discovered, actually, this is not right. We're doing the wrong process in the wrong circumstances with the wrong people or whatever. You know, something isn't good here. So what am I going to do about it? Well, you might pause it and say, look, I'm going to speak to the boss or whatever. It depends on the setup, of course. Something has to be done to deal with this. We're going to pause the process right now, or I'll leave you getting busy while I go and talk to somebody who might help. So, yeah, not everything always goes swimmingly for facilitators. And when you find yourself in trouble, then you need to get yourself out of that trouble. And hopefully without causing anybody any distress. I mean, for instance, I was running a process. We were supposedly doing visions and values and things with people well into a process, and things were going very well. But then somehow I realized that these people that I was working with didn't share a purpose. They all assumed that they did, but it was clear to me that there were various clues that said, actually, no, we haven't got a common purpose. That's what we needed to have done. We should have done that first before we did all this other stuff. So I spoke to the boss, who was actually part of the group in this particular case, and said, I need to redesign this, what we're doing, because this is a lack of alignment. And if we get that alignment, then it can be so much better. And in fact, this was a residential program, and I managed to redesign it and do this extra bit all within the program at no extra cost, except cost to me and my brain cells. But it was a fabulous event because people responded well to my saying, we're in trouble here unless we do this other piece of work. We can do this other piece of work if we change the program, we sacrifice that and that, and we put this in, and they agreed to it. And so together we did this. It was a wonderful thing to get this total change. And it was the spontaneity and the playfulness again of it that we came out of it very successfully. But as I was mentioning earlier, there have been a couple of occasions when we didn't manage to do that. It didn't work.
Hi, this is Andrew. I'm a facilitator and head of customer success at Session Lab, the dynamic workshop planner tool. More than 30,000 facilitators, trainers and coaches use our workshop planner tool and save time and effort in the design process. So how do they do it? Our drag-and-drop agenda builder makes it easy to transform your ideas into high-quality workshops, and the timing of your agenda automatically updates when you make changes. You can collaborate in real time with your colleagues and easily share professional-looking printouts with your clients. And if you need inspiration, you can check out our library of more than 500 activities and exercises and simply drag the ones you need right into your workshop agenda. So check out Session Lab to save time and effort in your workshop design process. And now get your first 2 months of Session Lab Pro absolutely free at sessionlab.com/workshopswork.
So from your experience, what is it that makes a workshop fail?
Well, it's having the wrong process or the wrong... there's a misfit, I would say, because a workshop is a creative process, should be a creative process. You might lose sight of that when you're repeating workshops and so on, but there's something creative in it. Otherwise, why are you doing it? It's so people can learn, so they come out stronger. But if you've misunderstood or been misled, so there are misunderstandings, it might not be your fault, but it is part of your responsibility, and therefore I think you can have the courage to say to the client, something is not right here. We need to consider, because something is not right and I don't want to let you down. So let's look at this. Let's set up a meeting, or let's immediately, right now, in the room, you know, we can flip chart all the things that are concerns that we're failing to address, or whatever it is, you know. So I think honesty and openness and a willingness to take the risks are quite important.
Yeah.
I think it's always a risk, is there not? I find I'm often taking risks with people. You take the risk of standing in front of people and talking as if you know what you're talking about. That's already a risk of standing up and speaking.
And
you want them to take risks on their part. So you build, as it were, a container in which risk-taking is the norm. We're all going to take some risks.
And feel safe.
And be safe, yes. Yeah. That's right. That's very important.
And when I listen to you of these skills or the role of a facilitator in these situations, it sounded to me actually pretty much we could have replaced the word facilitator by a leader. These are all leadership skills as well. So where's, according to you, the difference or the similarities? Where the overlap between facilitation and leadership?
It's a very good question, that, because indeed there are huge overlaps and maybe not many differences really, ultimately, between leadership and facilitation. However, I would take care of the difference between leadership as what leaders do and leadership in this more facilitative sense. In our modern society, we do think of we need leadership, therefore we need leaders. No, you are the leaders. So in the popular press and so on, they will talk about, we need a leader to help us out of this situation. Not necessarily so. What we need is leadership to get us out of the situation. And that may not equate to the sort of people that we've become used to calling leader. In our current society, we've equated leader with power. So we look at the leaders that we have in our country, and they tend to be the people who have power. But there's a different way of understanding leadership as being a flow of energy and resources, but primarily energy, ideas between people. Leadership is a quality of relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Like in this conversation, Miriam, you and I have been playing a little leadership game, and you've done it very well at your part, I have to say. You have led me to speaking about things in a way that I appreciate. You know, thank you very much. So supposing we were members of a leadership team, we could all similarly relate in a way that is mutually supportive, mm-hmm. that it draws out from one another our best attributes,
mm-hmm.
and that would be, I think, leadership at its best. Leadership as a flow of something between us, rather than something that I have or something that you have.
Which is then also a flow between leading and following. So it's inviting to inquire, inviting to investigate, to make sense, to feed back.
Yes.
So it sounds to me like a back and forth between leading and following a conversation or thought.
Possibly so. And there might be 10 of us doing this. So, and that, the leadership and followership roles are switching around moving around between us a lot. That is different from the kind of followership that leaders, in the power sense of it, require. Those leaders want you to be follower all the time. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Because I'm the leader, you're the follower. So we lose the dynamic in it. It's a system that works. It's worked a lot in military situations, for instance, or uniformed services. It's very difficult for people in uniformed services to have this more dynamic kind of leadership, because I can see by the amount of gold on your head, on your shoulders, that you're a very important person, and therefore you must be the leader and I'm just a follower. Now, it works all right for certain situations. It's very important in some situations that it's very clear who is the boss.
Mm. Yeah? Someone has to make the decision and to carry the responsibility for it.
Indeed. So, and it's very important in those situations that all of the rest of us just follow and do as we're told. But that's only in certain situations. It's not universal by any means. Because the trouble is, if I am the boss and I'm telling you what to do, and I might occasionally listen to what you say, but not too much, in those situations, first of all, I'm totally responsible. Assume that I have all the information that I need. I don't need to listen to your small talk. And I assume my decisions are wise and infallible. Mm. That's rarely the case. And how much more exciting it is when we're with a group of people, maybe even a large group, and we can just listen to what people say and we can go with the flow. And the leadership is something that's emerging. It's an emergent quality between us. It's a quality of our relationships. If we're not relating well, it's hard to find it. If we're relating well, then it's a wonderful creative force that we're all helping to sustain.
And to me, it sounds, and maybe I'm just hearing that because I want to hear that most probably, is that leaders, in the sense that you're describing it, where leaders open space for conversations and conversations to happen to then make a decision that aligns to the purpose, that these leaders need to be facilitators.
I would recommend that you stop using the word leader. It confuses things. Leadership flourishes with facilitation. Mm. It flourishes with playfulness. It flourishes when people are relaxed and happy. Then they can be most creative, and leadership can happen as an emergent quality of the relationships between the people. I think you sent me a picture of people dancing.
Yes, I sent you. It was a blog post I wrote.
I wish I could dance. I don't dance at all. Well, I'm very, not really. But in the arts, in dance, in music, you know, jazz, for instance, you know, you get a lot of this flow going on between people, a creative flow, because people are able to be spontaneous.
Mm.
Now, I'm sure you will have found that in groups, that it's possible to have a group of people in a room, and you may be trying to produce a bit of print, or you're going to do a presentation or a show of some sort. When that group is really behaving spontaneously and creatively together, sparks flying and wonderful ideas are emerging, and you're building on all of that. No one person is leader. This leadership is happening in the spontaneity. And I think this is a very interesting thing. You've got leadership, but you've got, you know, you don't have leaders. Or are they all leaders, or nobody's a leader? Yeah, as you describe it, it's fair enough. You lead, I follow. Then I lead and you follow. I mean, I used to be a mountaineer. Mm-hmm. And they talk about, you know, when you've got two people on a rope, you have a leader, Mm-hmm. And the other one's called a second, not a follower, but anyway. And when you're really on top of your game and you're leading up beautiful snow slopes and rocks and things, and then the other guy comes up, you know, the second person is there to protect, really, because mm-hmm. you've got a rope. But when you've got this, you then do something that's called leading through. So you lead up, the second guy comes up, and then he leads the next one. So you're swapping over. And it becomes it's like dancing. Yeah. Because, you know, the lead is swapping from one to the other. So leadership is there all the time, but it's not always the same person. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it's wrong to talk about a leader. Unless we say, well, we're all leaders.
And then I feel tempted to provoke you a bit now. because in all this playfulness and all this creativity and all this dancing, at one point, someone needs to decide. And sometimes, in the best of all cases, the groups comes to a decision together, which makes sense. Perfect scenario. Sometimes this doesn't happen. And isn't it in these situations that you actually need a leader? And I think this is, to answer my own question that I asked previously, the main difference then maybe between a leader and a facilitator is that a facilitator doesn't take decisions, but makes the process of finding a decision easy. But at some point?
I think when a group works well, it doesn't have to resort to taking votes, for instance. Mm-hmm. I think this facilitating where you get people to vote with sticky dots and so on, it's all right. It gives a sort of sense of priorities, but it's not a decision-making process. Mm-hmm. If you're facilitating well, the decision emerges. It doesn't have to be done by some kind of democratic process. Democracy, I think, is misleading. It's weak compared with good facilitation. If you facilitate well, then the group has already decided. It doesn't have to take votes. You don't have to have somebody say, oh, well, all right, then thank you for your input. This is what we're going to do. But no.
How do you know? If there's no voting, how do you know that a group arrived?
If you co-design, mm-hmm. if you co-create, then there's no alternative, in a sense. You've co-created your solution, so you've bought into it. Now, then you maybe have to commit to it. That's mm-hmm. different. So, for instance,
where the hairy problem starts.
Yeah, with groups that I've worked with, we may have done a lot of co-designing. We've spent a few days and we come up with some grand scheme of things. And we know how that's going to be implemented. But then I would always find a way of saying, have we committed to this? Mm. It's not just a nice idea. We can have lots of nice ideas, but to be committed is something quite different and very important too. Yeah. So there's a choice to be made. And so this would be a way to do it. You could say, okay, there are 12 of us in the room. This is what we've come up with. We've said this is what we think is the right thing to do. If you don't agree with this, leave the room.
Law of two feet.
And if you stay in the room, then you're going to be committed to this. You have to be sure that you have agreed with every detail. Look each other in the eyes. Have you agreed with this? Is this really what you will do? Yeah, so, and that's very different from saying all those in favor raise their right hand.
True. And it's actually... And
those against.
It's a very good differentiation because a decision as such is worthless if there's no commitment behind it.
Yes.
Because then it's just a decision that will never be executed or enforced or whatsoever.
Yes, it's half-hearted.
When you work with leadership teams, what's your favorite exercise to get them maybe to play or to open up?
one thing I like to do is to use collage.
Mm-hmm.
Collage is, again, it's like taking kids back to school. You get out your scissors and your sticky tape, your sticky stuff, and here are some pictures you can cut up. It's playful. And what I tend to use this very early on in the program, and it's usually to do with feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So it's getting people to surface some of their feelings in a way that is non-threatening.
Mm-hmm.
You could take a typical bunch of managers, say there are nine of them. I would have them work in threes. Two is a bit too
intimate,
polarizing.
Mm-hmm.
So three is a really good number. Threes or fours, and I give them a pile of magazines and scissors and sticky stuff and a piece of paper. I say, okay, now you're going to make a collage, usually in a very short time, 10 minutes. It's too short a time for them to be able to think, really.
Mm-hmm.
They can't, you know, they've only got a bunch of magazines. They haven't got neatly separated little pictures of this, that and the other, or different colours. It's magazines, picture magazines, you know, typical women's magazines are excellent for it. They're usually stuffed with pictures, lots of pictures.
How do they react when you hand over a bunch of women magazines to the, I guess, mostly male managers?
Mostly male, and they all go for the glamorous pictures, of course. But it's fine because it already gives them, you know, humour comes into it immediately. As a You send them off into separate groups in different places, and they start ripping up pictures or cutting out pictures, not knowing quite what they're going to do. You give them a subject. It's usually, I mean, I'd say, what's it feel like to be in this team at the moment? Mm. What are our feelings? So just that, a very short thing, and I say, there's the magazines, you cut them up, you assemble a collage. It's a joint work of art. There are three of you doing it, or four of you, not one. There are a number of people putting this picture together. So they start tearing stuff out. So someone have picked out all the nice-looking ladies and the car, fast cars or whatever it is. They, you know, they go for their stereotypical material.
And in this way, they really share their understanding and might find the differences in how they see the team in a non-confrontational way. Yeah, I can.
It brings it all out. So very quickly, they've got to assemble this thing. It's usually often not a very good collage.
Mm.
But sometimes people do produce very, very good stuff, even though they've got this incredibly short time to do it in.
Yeah.
Now, I'd set them off and say 10 minutes. Well, it might be 15. I'll extend it a bit if necessary. Then you get people to bring these things back into the shared space and display them.
Mm-hmm.
And let's talk about them. So you say, okay, let's hear from the artist for this one. Let's hear from these people. And so somebody will say, oh, and this was very, oh, and that's the boss doing so. And, you know, so they take you through this stuff. It's usually very entertaining. And of course, the thing is to you as the facilitator maintain the humour and you set the scene and so on. That here we are as artists. We're only talking about these pictures we've ripped out of a magazine. We're not really talking about what we think of the boss and all of that.
Yeah.
But that's what comes out, of course.
Beautiful.
So, and then you give them a round of applause and move on to the next one. It's a very good exercise. I would recommend you try it if you have never done it.
I will. And I'm curious.
You maintain the humour. You bring in the playfulness. It's there. You've immediately created all those things that you want.
I can perfectly see that. And I would like to close with another aspect of your work where you just published a book about leadership.
Mm.
And I would be curious what you have learned about leadership from facilitating all these leadership teams.
Well, I think I've been interested in leadership long before I ever thought of myself as a facilitator. In fact, I think I've been interested in leadership since I was a Boy Scout.
Good way to learn about leadership in the Boy Scouts, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's the beginnings of it. But I think that leadership is, in the book, I talk about leadership as meaning making. I think that this thing that we call leadership, this phenomenon that occurs between people, creates a context. Now, we've talked about purpose. So purpose and vision and values and all of those things, they create a context in which people's work becomes meaningful. They create a context in which life becomes meaningful. Work that isn't meaningful isn't worth doing. I mean, it's terrible if you condemn people to work meaninglessly. I mean, there's that apocryphal tale of somebody encountering a cleaner at NASA and asking them what they were doing, and the guy says, you know, he's mopping the floor, but he said, I'm putting a man on the moon. So that guy, I mean, insofar as there's maybe a grain of truth in this story, that guy saw that what he was doing was connected.
Yeah.
Totally inseparable from putting a man on the moon. So it should be for everybody in their work. They should feel that what they're doing really has significance. Mm. Significance, meaning. It's connected with some grand purpose, you know. I might be just typing somewhere in an office in Amsterdam, but I'm running the city. I'm making sure that Amsterdam is a beautiful place to visit and will make its citizens proud. That's what I'm doing, even though you might think I'm just doing something menial. So it should be for everybody. We should all be connected with something that's really significant. We're making a better planet. We're making a better society. And as facilitators, we need to connect with this very strongly, because we, as facilitators, are leading the leaders, you might say. We're involved in this leadership process. So it's very important that facilitators realize that they're not just satisfying this client that's in front of them right now. They are contributing to the quality of society by ensuring that people have good processes that help them to clarify what they're about and what their contribution is.
I love what you're saying. And I truly believe that if our world leaders, if we may call them that way, if they had better workshop facilitators, we would live in a better world.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So it's quite important, I think, that facilitators, you might just think, oh, I'm just a facilitator. I work with just junior managers, or I work with the community groups. Yes, but you are a facilitator, and this is a very important role. Your role is to raise the game, not just to help people do what they're already setting out to do, but to raise the game.
Yeah. Leading the leaders, guiding them, yeah.
Or raise guiding aspirations. Them. Yeah. You know, let's build a better world. And we as facilitators are very well placed to make a difference. But we have to decide to do it. We're back to that thing of, you know, choosing. Do you choose to take this on, this challenge?
How to deal with this responsibility? That's a huge responsibility. And I'm not sure whether the leaders, the self-called leaders, would be happy to hear that.
Well, yeah, there may be leaders who, so-called leaders, who would not. But if you're in a position of trying to run a hospital, say, particularly right now, and therefore people look to you for leadership, well, first of all, you would push it back to them and say, well, what about your leadership? Yeah, we're in this together. We need everybody's contribution. And if here's a facilitator who says, I can help you change the game, fine, come along and do it. Prove it to me. I don't think you should put leaders down just because they're leaders. They have a tough role to play. And they're stuck in a situation where they've got dumb people saying to them, well, tell me what to do and I'll do it. No, you find out what to do.
And then lifting the individuals in this process.
Lifting the groups. All this comes back down to what is the purpose of life?
Yeah.
What is your purpose in life? Your purpose in life is to live it to the full, to give what you have to give, to have drawn out from you everything that you can be, so that everything can be maximized. I mean, going back to my book, the subtext, I would say, really, is that because there is a subtitle, which is the hero's, take the hero's journey to transformation. The hero's journey is not to become a hero, is to become transformed, to become whole as a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all challenged with this. We come into the world as little kids thinking that we own the place, and then we discover that that's not the case. But we can rediscover and recreate ourselves so that hopefully by the end of our lives, we know that we have lived it well, that we've become all that we could be, and that we've given all that we had to give, and that others can look at our legacy and say, well, they did that well.
Yeah, coming back to the purpose. So if you were a hashtag, if you had to summarize who you are in one word, what would it be?
It might be aspire.
Mm.
Because aspiration is really, that is that reaching for the stars. Learning is quite important. So I think that it's important to realize that learning is not about knowledge. Learning is about being, becoming. Learn to be more.
And to do less.
And that's where aspiration is really important. Whatever you're doing, wherever you are in life, then to be aspiring is very important indeed.
I love that. Focusing less on this inspiration, but on the aspiration to actually achieve something.
There's no point in being inspired unless you have some aspiration.
Beautiful.
If you have aspiration, then you find the inspiration.
Mm. I find this very inspiring as a thought.
Yes.
And as we are approaching the hour, I wonder if someone fell asleep after minute one of our conversation, just woke up and doesn't have time to listen to the full hour. What would you like them to take away?
Well, I'd like them to want to go back, really, and listen to what they missed. So I think it's been a very interesting conversation. I'm sorry I've done most of the talking, but that was the roles that we adopted at the beginning.
That's why I invited you.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think we have aspired to think about facilitation as if we were seeing it from afar. And seeing that facilitation is a process between people. We might have a facilitator who is orchestrating it, and that's a useful role, but it is essentially a process between people that at its best becomes a flow of leadership, that we would call leadership as a dynamic interaction between the people. And that's a wonderful kind of leadership to experience. And it doesn't necessarily need a facilitator, but a good facilitator will bring that along in their bag and make the magic happen. It's a kind of magic, and it's a wonderful thing to experience when it happens.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing your time, your thoughts, your experience with us. John.
Thank you, Miriam, for your lovely spirit of inquiry.
Thank you. Now I'm looking forward to your book launch, and I will put all the links in the show notes.
Thank you for staying tuned and listening to the show.
I appreciate your attention as I know how busy you are. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and engage by sharing your comments and thoughts, and visit workshops.org to download the one-page summary. I'm looking forward to seeing you back at the next episode, and I wish you a fruitful day.